Thank goodness I wasn't killed. I'm sorry I'm so inarticulate. I can't name it then, but I feel the words at least eroding my voice. I sense that at least marks an end to the story I'm supposed to tell, that I am supposed to say something gracious in response. Thank goodness. Or else nothing more at all. At least curbs my telling too much truth. It's a blunt instrument wielded to club a reckless retelling into submission. The story ends here. But the truth is, I have no story. Nothing I can corral into a coherent narrative. 4. One wants a teller in a time like this. Gwendolyn Brooks. 5. That which is not a coherent narrative appears everywhere. In the classrooms where I stop talking, in the school-mandated therapist's office where we face off in silence for 45 minutes each week, in food which I eat too much of or not at all. When my best friend comes up behind me and wraps me in a hug, the anger darts up my chest and I instinctively push him away. Hard. A few days later, I show up at his house, inexplicably shaking after another friend ran up behind me as I was walking home from the library. "What happened?" he asks. "Nothing," I tell him. "It was nothing." 6. You know that moment when you trip and you are poised with equal possibility to fall flat on your face and to take the next step and your heart shoots up into your throat? Every second feels split, normality and catastrophe equally plausible. The assumptions I once cobbled into a day no longer hold. There is not a man hiding behind that tree. No one will break into my apartment and kill me while I sleep. I will be able to sleep until the morning. I will be here in the morning. The stones that composed the ground on which I've always walked have come loose, swirling unpredictably around my head. And here I feel myself saying it. At least I have ground. 7. Eventually, I go to a small liberal arts college in New England. It's beautiful, which is true, and also something people say over and over when they don't want to talk about other truths, like the relationship between the institution's vast resources and the rampant poverty in the post-industrial towns that surround us, or how the brochures boast that we don't have frats, but the culture of fraternities clings instead to sports teams. 8. A friend is assaulted by an adjunct professor. The deans tell her to keep it quiet. A sophomore is pressing charges against a student who raped her at a party. The school takes no measures to keep him away from her. Her friends take turns sleeping in her room. Their grades drop. Their relationships become strained. These are the stories we tell each other, quietly. 9. Sometimes people tell me that something bad happened to me, but I am brave and strong. I don't want to be told that I am brave or strong. I am not right just because he was wrong. I don't want to be made noble. I want someone willing to watch me thrash and crumple, because that, too, is the truth and it needs a witness. "He broke me," I say to a friend. "You're not broken," she whispers back. I turn my palms up, wishing I could show her the pieces. 10. In college, I write my senior thesis about Audre Lorde, June Jordan, and Pat Parker, three queer African-American poets who died of breast cancer. How, I want to know, do they give form to what is happening in their bodies, their minds, as they are dying? How do they make their way in the same language used to write them out of history books? Is it the same language? In so many ways, our contexts are different, but I am beginning to understand that my own white learned unresponsiveness to the shapes of their questions has something to do with the ongoing violence at the heart of this nation. Jordan wrote, "In the same way that so many Americans feel that we have lost our jobs, we suspect that we have lost our country. We know that we do not speak the language. And I ask you, well, what are we going to do about it?" "We must," she says, "make language accountable to the truths of our experience." She advises us to turn away from the commonplace. "I was raped." When I read these words, I am in a carrel in the basement of the library, my knees pressed to my chest, my elbows tight against my knees. I read the words again, "Put the book down." I stand up. I stretch my arms toward the ceiling. I trust June Jordan with her scimitar brilliance and truth-telling ethic, the activist and poet who wrote, "I am black and I am female and I am a mother and I am bisexual and I am a nationalist and I am an anti-nationalist, and I mean to be fully and freely all that I am." Jordan, who refused to see contradictions as conflicting, who insisted that the difficult truth is also the site of her girding question, "Where is the love?" I take a deep breath and settle back into my chair, poised to receive the new language I know she will give me to speak my experience. The victim must learn to make language tell her own truth. "He raped me." I am devastated. I don't want to be made the object in my retelling. "I was raped," I whisper. That too feels wrong. I set the book down on the table. 11. When I was little, I used to curl up in the black and white striped armchair in our living room with a thick book. Sometimes I would read, but often I just held the book in my lap as a signal to passers-by to let me be while my imagination roved. I treasured these moments of quiet. I grew into them, stretching out my girl mind into the implausible and absurd. I love my quiet. I hate how, in the after, my quiet has become silence. The room in my chest that was skylit has become a sealed and padded cell. 12. B. Somewhere in this essay is a love letter to you. Your love brought me back to my quiet. I needed a new language. I needed a new story, one where I don't have to remember the beginning and don't know the end. This is a love letter to our love, which was never the kind of durable love that built itself around errands and taxes. It was all our bodies and your brilliance, your language and where our language trailed off together into something dark and shimmering, like the sea, like the mud, like the shape of my imagination when I clutched a book for its world and its heft, like the Nashville summer nights when lightning bugs gifted their tiny glow, unjarred, all halo. All fleeting. 13. Judith Butler says that we suffer from our condition of addressability. My body feels like my condition, and everything feels like an address. 14. I look for them everywhere, women like me, and they find me, too. A teacher in my high school tells me, crying, it happened to me almost 30 years ago, as I wonder whether 3 decades will sediment any of this for me. They are in the newspaper where the truth of their testimony is prodded, the victim claimed, she believes. They are on the other end of the rape and sexual assault hotline I volunteer with in college. We sit next to each other on the bus. We recognize each other, or we don't. My beautiful friend in graduate school says to me, I sit down and I just lose time. I know, I say. 15. In my notebook, I write, create. There are parts of you even you can't give away. 16. Go to court. Don't go to court. Get a rape kit. Don't get a rape kit. Don't take a class with that teacher. He's handsy. Don't take a class with her. She's unsympathetic. Don't watch violent movies. Don't watch movies that might be violent. Don't be angry. If you're angry, explain why, calmly. If I were you, I wouldn't wear that. I'd rather be dead than be raped. I'd rather be dead than be you. Don't talk about rape. Do you have proof? Don't get defensive. Avoid your triggers. Don't eat at restaurants with steak knives. Are you eating? You look thin. You look fat. No one's going to want to go home with you. Don't let people you don't know into your home. Who do you really know anyway? Don't walk alone at night. Don't not walk alone at night. This is your life. This is your life. This is your life. 17. After college, I moved back to Nashville. My girlfriend, M, is a social worker, and she's heard from a colleague of hers of a lesbian therapist who specializes in PTSD. Do you want to try? She asks me. Not really, I tell her, thinking of the mutual stare down with the therapist I saw in high school, thinking of the doctor who asked if I was gay before, thinking that I am really, all things considered, finally doing okay. I have a job teaching high school. I can sleep for hours at a time. I can go days, sometimes weeks, without having flashbacks. M looks at me with exhaustion. I guess I'll try, I say. A smile pops onto M's face like it's been released by my acquiescence. The therapist's office is attached to her home. She invites me in. I sit on a brown corduroy armchair. She asks me a series of intimate questions as though reading directions for shampoo use. I answer her equally sterilely. 2, are you religious? I say, Jewish. Do you have siblings? A younger brother? Have you experienced trauma? I say, I was beaten and raped when I was 16, as though agreeing, yes, wash, rinse, repeat. Oh, she pauses, looking up at me. At least you weren't killed, she says, writing something down in her notebook. M looks hopeful when she picks me up. How was it? It was fine, I say, and thank her for coming to get me. In our next session, the therapist says we are beginning eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. I read that the first step involves holding aspects of the traumatic event in mind. I tell her I don't think I'm ready. She tells me it will be helpful. I wonder if I can say no. She probably knows what's best. She tells me to visualize the part of the scene I remember most strongly. I throw up in her bathroom. That night, I sleep on the couch. The next day, I call my friend Anisha and tell her I will never go to therapy again. After a sleepless night fighting to keep the past from consuming my present, I am furious that everything I've worked so hard to rebuild seems to have crumbled. It feels like I'm right back there in the week after it happened. The stakes are too high, I say. I had it all under control. I can deal with this myself. Anisha tells me, a good therapist knows you have to live in the house while you remodel. 18. I lay awake all night thinking about how I am completely exhausted, staving off sleep and trying to stop thinking about what might happen if I allow myself to close my eyes. I watch the sun rise, which tells me it's time to start again. 19. I find H on the Psychology Today website, a blog that also allows you to search for therapists. According to the site, H is the only therapist in my area who has noted that he sees transgender clients and whose description doesn't strike me as completely disingenuous. I'm cisgender, but I imagine a therapist who only sees cis clients has little understanding of gender and little recourse for facilitating healing. We set up an appointment. At the end of the session, I am amazed at myself for sitting in a room alone with a man for 45 minutes. I tell H so, and he nods. We talk during our sessions, or we don't. At the end of each meeting, I promise to come back next week. A therapist with an office down the hall from H has a dog. I tell H I saw the dog and he's adorable. H asks me if I'd like the dog to be at one of our sessions. I say yes. I am surprised when, the following week, the dog is in H's office waiting for me. I don't want to thank H. Instead, I say, I've never really said all of it out loud. H does not say, what are you talking about? He does not say, really, 8 years later? Or, at least you weren't killed. H says, I'm here to listen if you want to tell me. And then, if you don't want to speak, I'm still here. Will it help? I ask. I want a definitive answer, even as I suspect that men with definitive answers about my body have something to do with why I'm there in the first place. It might, H says. Some people find it helpful. Others don't. I say nothing. To make a narrative of what I don't remember feels like a lie. There is no sense here. I stare at a photograph of a huge and knotted tree on H's desk, but out of the corner of my eye, I can see him there, nodding, like my quiet and not knowing is something to affirm. His kindness threatens to loose everything I have wrapped so tightly. 20. Everything changed that night. I repeat it to myself like a mantra, shoving down the question that keeps bubbling up. How can it be that not everything changed? The same dumb sun, the same impossible horizon. Beauty hurts. It enters me even as I have fortified myself to keep everything out. 21. I realized that I read Jordan wrong. I took her language rather than joining her project. I saw, he raped me. She first said, the victim must learn to make language tell her own truth. I made something from it, but I'm not better for it. 22. I am not sorry, and I am not grateful. 23. Wislawa Szymborska says, I can do only two things. Describe this flight and not add a last line.
The Luckiest MILF in Brooklyn by Lynn Melnick. Come here, MILF tits. Sweet tits, hot tits, sugar tits. Oh, hi. Here I am, MILF tits. Still valid, I guess, still viable. MILFy, but tits all the same. I've been a D-cup since 7th grade, so my breasts have been up for public conversation almost as long as I can remember, along with the rest of me, especially my ass, the way I walk, and how viable a fuck I am to passers-by. Do I want to smoke a joint in your car? No thanks. Why aren't I smiling? I've been having night terrors again, thanks for asking. You'd like to rub your dick all over my ass? Thanks for letting me know. I'm standing on the corner of my block, my home turf, in front of the public library with my younger daughter, not yet 4, who's holding an Olivia book and her stuffed cat. It's quiet. It's one of those days that looks like fall but feels like summer. The leaves whip around as traffic flows, but my daughter and I wear open-toed shoes. I'm in a sundress. Come, listen to me talk about why it doesn't matter what I'm wearing, why it's hot out and I shouldn't have to cover up. Why, it's not on me, it's on them. I talk a good game. I know the language and the reasoning. I'm tough, I'm badass, I'm right. And I blame myself. The dress could have shown less cleavage. Come here, MILF tits, calls a man out a car window. I want to fuck you sideways. I look down and away. I have a fearful history. I flinch at loud garbage truck brakes. I've literally been startled by my own kid's shadow. Silly mom, so silly. Why did that man yell at you? My daughter asks. I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for the objectification, and I'm embarrassed by my fear. I've been dealing with this for 30 years, and it doesn't change. Wasn't it supposed to have gone away by now? It didn't go away during my pregnancy or when I walked with a baby nestled in a wrap against my chest. It didn't magically evaporate on my 40th birthday. Shouldn't that be one of the benefits of age? Or am I buying into an ageist way of thinking that I might one day be seen by strangers as something beyond my sex appeal? I turn around and make eye contact with a cop standing outside the library. I gesture to him, like, what the hell? And he gestures back, like, what can you do? I don't know, you're just a cop and someone made me feel unsafe on the street. Never mind, I was wearing a sundress. I'm a D-cup. It's not like he touched you. It's not like he hurt you. It's not like he raped you. I'm supposed to be grateful because I wasn't raped. I'm supposed to be grateful because even though I walk through the world with MILF tits and a sundress, I wasn't raped. And I've been raped, and this is much better. So thank you. Today I stand outside the library, the luckiest MILF in Brooklyn. You still got it. It was when I was running late to my daughter's school pickup and a man called, slow down, I love to watch your fine ass move. And when I ignored him, added, you don't have to be a bitch, you're not that fine, that I finally took to social media to complain. I've been catcalled for decades, but I felt unequal to the task of having to switch gears from being in defense mode on the street to smiling at teachers and children. I wanted to know I'm not alone because I felt humiliated and alone. My online friends were very nice. Lots of solidarity, lots of word, and I'm sorry. Some women wondered why they didn't get street harassed, and they felt ambivalent about that. One man wrote, you still got it. I'm 42. I'll admit 42 is not what I thought 42 would be, but then I had given very little thought to how middle age might present itself. Objectively, and if I'm lucky, I've likely lived half my life, and it's been a good one for longer than I ever thought possible. I live in a city that I love, married to a man that I love. I've published a couple of books, had a couple of kids that I schlep to and from school and activities because I'm fortunate to have a flexible work schedule. I get to the end of the day and I'm so fucking tired, I almost can't move my body from the couch to the bed, but it's a pleasure, that kind of tired. There was no predicting my life would be this. A couple of years ago, Esquire ran a Tom Junod piece in praise of 42-year-old women. Reaction ran the gamut from the BBC declaring us still sexy and the New York Daily News reassuring us we can still be hot to the more sensible feminist media bristling at the premise that there used to be something tragic about the 42-year-old woman because the odds that we were fuckable had long since started to tip. Important lesson. Listen. I should be honored to be objectified now that I'm 42. I should be grateful. I should have slowed down because I'm not that fine. I'm 42. I should be glad anyone finds me sexually viable. I'm short, round, wear glasses, didn't get my chipped front teeth fixed until a couple of years ago because I didn't know how to let go of what my life had been, didn't know that I deserved that. I couldn't look in the mirror for years. I have a C-section scar and a few other scars. The skin around my lower midsection is slack from 2 full-term pregnancies. I can hardly remember to shave in summer, and when I do, it feels like a statement of some sort. I smoked for 2 decades, and there are lines around my lips. I rarely wear makeup. I'm sure I'm softer than ever if I could remember what my body was like before. I spent too long defined by how others perceived me, how it felt to others when they touched me. Now I feel so good to myself, but important lesson, listen, my face is falling. It's all falling, isn't it? I'm 42. But wait, I still got it. I am not a waste of a body moving through space. I can still bring the titillation wherever I go. If I would just be more amenable, more grateful, you're not hurting me, you're complimenting me. Smile and say thank you. Stop, you're talking to me. You see me, and I'm 42 years old. You want to fuck me, and I'm 42 years old. Old, old, old. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for the nice things you say. I had to stop going to the corner bakery one recent summer because a man working there wouldn't stop creeping on me, even when I was with my children. He'd give me my change and slide his hand slowly across mine. He'd tell me I looked sexy. He'd tell me how beautiful I am, and then he'd nod to my kids. He'd stare at me so hard that I felt like if I moved, I'd stumble. A couple of times he followed just behind me on the sidewalk making grunting noises. I couldn't get the courage to say, please stop. I know what it feels like to be held down, and I know what it feels like to be hit in the face. I know that saying, please stop, made it no more likely that these things would stop. I quit going to the bakery, even though their coffee is essential to my functioning as a human. So there I was, in my neighborhood, altering my behavior to try to avoid being harassed. Luckily, fall semester came and he went back to study at school. Here's a partial list, just off the top of my head right now, of all the places I've dreaded, feared, or even stopped going to because I felt exposed, harassed, creeped on. The bakery, the pizza place, the deli across from work, the deli in my office building, the closer entrance to the subway, the playground with the baby swings, the playground with the frog statue, my daughter's ballet school waiting room, a poetry reading I'd just given, a poetry reading as I was giving it, walking my kids to school, picking my kids up from school, the construction site to the left of my building, the construction site to the right of my building, the airport, the train station, the zoo. A couple of years ago, I was part of a question and answer session involving poetry and photography when an older man in the audience thought a good question to ask was, I'm paraphrasing, why, when I look so nice and respectable and pretty and kinda hot, well, why do you write all these nasty poems with sex and violence in them? Are these about you really? Which parts are true? The room seemed silent forever, but it was probably just a second before I said, wow, okay. I didn't know how to respond. Ugh, because then I said, thank you for the nice things you say, and babbled on about something that included statistics about intimate partner violence, just because I know them, just because my fear of men beating me is not sexy. But what if I am some kind of Trojan horse of respectability? I was thrown. This panel was a major deal for me, career-wise. I was being taken seriously in a room of serious artists, and I was trying like heck to take myself seriously. And there I was, being objectified in front of the entire audience. I blamed myself. If you wrote poems about the weather, if you hadn't belted your dress so tight, if you could talk more intelligently. So what if I thanked my objectifier? So what if so much of my day involves de-escalation? I'll take my lumps to avoid worse. I should be grateful that I can. I should be grateful that this is what I'm complaining about. I should be grateful that I don't currently fear for my life. Grateful, grateful, grateful. You'll miss it when it's gone. I was invisible for years. I was quiet, shell-shocked. I didn't want the attention, but maybe would have liked it. In fourth grade, about halfway through the school year, I accidentally went to the wrong classroom and sat there, and no one realized except me, who burned hot until the end of the day. I didn't even know which would have been better, being found out or not being found out. It was all too much. This was just before I hit puberty. By sixth grade, I was a B cup and growing fast. It was confusing but exhilarating because suddenly I was seen. At home, it was something we didn't speak about, and I was afraid to ask for a bra to admit my burgeoning sexual self, so I just bounced around the school to the delight of the boys who had known me since kindergarten, a good 6 years before I mattered. At lunchtime, I'd go behind the cafeteria with one boy or another and let them fondle me in exchange for cigarettes, which I didn't smoke yet, but stored away in a box my grandmother had bought me. But, let's face it, the attention was its own payment. By seventh grade, I learned to give blowjobs in exchange for wine coolers. The semen and the alcohol slid down my throat with such certainty, I didn't know how to start saying no. By eighth grade, I depended on the alcohol, and by ninth grade, when I was kicked out of school for drugs, I had no doubt that the only thing I had to offer the world was my body, and the world pretty much confirmed that for a long time. Hey, sexy, why are you walking away? Come sit on my lap and tell me why you look so sad. Looking fine, Mama. I was walking home from a day at the emergency room. Eventually, and not long from now, as my oldest is 10, my daughters will be publicly harassed on the street, and I will be powerless to stop it. It is very likely that we could be harassed on the same day, that we will find ourselves back in our safe, charmingly untidy apartment, still tender from the words hurled by strangers. I am incompetent, a failure. For the first time since my oldest was a newborn, I feel unequal to the task of parenting. My daughters get fed a lot of phony girl power through books and television and clubs at school. And then they go into the schoolyard where they get their real messages. They catch ads in the subway. They overhear conversations at the diner. I take them to the Lego movie, much admired, roundly praised, critical darling. And they watch as the main female character is objectified throughout the entire thing. We need a break from all this empowerment. I'm standing on the corner of 22nd and 6th in Manhattan. Miss, miss, a man's voice calls to me, and I think, it can't be me, I'm no miss. And I think, what if it's me? Please leave me alone. And he taps me on the shoulder. I flinch because I flinch, and he says, I just wanted to say I like your dress. Holy crap, he just wants to say he likes my dress. It's a whole new world. At 42, still got it. MILF tits. The harassment has certainly, thankfully, slowed. But it doesn't seem to want to go away altogether. And even though it happens much less frequently than it used to, I flinch and brace myself every time I leave my apartment. I wonder if, when it finally stops for good, if it will be too late to relax, if the muscle memory of the harassment will keep me tense on the sidewalk forever. I try to understand when people tell me they enjoy it, when women my age say they miss being called names, or when they get a kick out of being called to so explicitly. I want to fuck your asshole. I was wearing a down coat. I'd like to put my cock between those titties. Ugly cunt, I'm talking to you. I know what it's like to feel invisible as a child, and I imagine it feels the same as an adult. But it's a pretty sorry situation when the choice is either objectification by intimidating strangers or invisibility. Once or twice in my life, I swear to you, I've done things other than be a body available for men to enjoy or reject. But I know I have no right to complain. I am lucky. I've been allowed one more day as a woman on this earth, relatively unviolated. Shouldn't that be enough? Lucky, lucky, lucky.
Spectator. My Family, My Rapist, and Mourning Online by Brandon Taylor. One of the men who raped me, W, is dying from cancer, and I'm watching it happen via Facebook. The man who raped me is married to my aunt and is the father of my cousin who was, at one time, my closest friend in a family in which friends and love were rare. He is not the only man who raped me, but he is the only one who raped me and refused to leave because he was stitched into my life like an ugly scar from a wound healed wrong. It has been strange to watch him die after wishing for his death for so long, to see it unfold through the lens of my cousin's pain, so at odds with the frustration and fear I felt watching my own mother die. I have watched his face suck in and his enormous gut dwindle at first to a flat surface and then a concave one. There are no pictures of him looking directly into the camera. I don't think I could bear them anyway. He always seems to be looking away or up or down at the periphery even when at the center of things. There are no direct details about his cancer, his impending death, or his treatment. There are no specifics. It's all hazy and soft, the way things are on the internet with the strangers we imagine we know. W's brother died of cancer. They are twins, their bodies made of the same parts, and so in one way it doesn't surprise me. There are times when I cough and I think this is it. This is the moment when my body betrays me and reverts to my mother's body. I imagine that there are ways in which our bodies never really stop being our mother's bodies. In the bath, I trace my fingers along the lines of myself like a person following a river to its source. When I laugh like her, or when I'm mean like her, or when I go cold and distant like her, I can feel her lingering, ready to claim what is hers and has always been hers. If her body could betray her, my body could certainly betray me. There are certain risk factors. I grew up in a family of smokers and breathed secondhand smoke every day for 18 years. I now have a family history because cancer has slammed into my life like an asteroid striking the earth, leaving behind a crater where my mother once stood. I live in an urban area and breathe the particulate that accumulates in such places. I do not have my mother's chronic cough, but the summer of her diagnosis, we had very similar symptoms. Painful swallowing, trouble breathing, sensitivity to acids and cold liquids. There was a moment, fleeting as these moments often are, when I thought the worst, when I feared the absolute worst. But the moment passed, for me. A month before my mother died, I got on a plane and went down to Alabama. I had been told that this would bring some measure of peace to her, but in retrospect, I can't help but to think of how cruel a thing it was to do. After all, when she saw me and I saw her, we wouldn't be able to hide from the fact that the whole thing was ending. There is a kind of magic to distance. As long as I stayed away, she could go on thinking that things weren't as bad as they were, and I could go on thinking that I was doing something good for her by doing nothing, by not talking about it or seeing it. My uncle was having a birthday barbecue in the middle of August, and by some random chance, the party fell on the third day of my 5-day trip. My mother was very tired. She found my presence irritating, which was flattering in a way. She wasn't putting on a show of wanting me around. I thought to myself that things might not be so bad after all. At least she wasn't trying to love on me as she had started to do with my brother. There were a lot of white gnats fluttering in the air like snowflakes with their own minds, so many of them pouring out of the pecan trees that the food had to be whisked directly from the grill and into the house. I was given the task of standing behind my mother and waving away the bugs from her. She leaned forward in her chair, swaying occasionally if she heard a song that she liked or felt a rhythm that moved her. People kept stopping by her chair to say a kind word to her on their way to grab beers from the cooler. She was loved by them. I stood behind her for about half an hour, and then I went up the back stairs to use the bathroom in my grandmother's house. I needed to be away from her and done with the impossibly tender act of fanning white gnats from her cropped hair. I stuck my head in the fridge and counted to 10, letting the cool air settle against my face and neck. Two of my young cousins came bounding into the house, laughing. They saw me, waved, and went directly to the back room. I leaned back against the fridge and closed my eyes. The air was so warm, so thick. It was a miserable day for a party. The music was loud, a kind of up-tempo blues, and omnipresent. I looked through the back door down the long stairs and saw my mother surrounded by her sisters and some of our distant cousins. It was familiar to me, this act of looking on from the back stairs. When I was younger, I used to do it all the time with my cousins when we were banished from the party as the sun went down. "Grown folks only," our mother said, shooing us into the house. "Go play." How strange to be back there. How strange to be watching it all unfold from a distance. I was grown now, wasn't I? I was old enough to join them, to be among the adults and to bear their burdens. When I was little, all I ever wanted was to be down there dancing with them, laughing and talking to them as equals, and now that I had permission, which is to say that I had grown past the age of needing to ask permission, all I wanted to do was sit in the house and not have to fan bugs from my mother's hair. I saw someone pick up the small hand towel I had been using. They looked around in confusion. It was my Aunt Arlene, the mean one with the waspy hand and stinging pinches. She'd turn me inside out if she caught me. So I took another breath, pushed open the door, and descended the stairs. She met me at the bottom with a firm look. "Bathroom," I said. She popped my thigh with the towel and pointed me back to my mother. "Get," she said. There is a picture of my mother at this party. She's flanked by relatives, peace signs up, smiling. It was the first time I realized that death had brought out in her an almost uncanny resemblance to my brother and my grandfather. Someone uploaded this picture to my mother's Facebook wall, and on the day she died, people streamed in to say how terribly sorry and sad they were that she was gone. I didn't say anything on social media, though relatives tried to tag me in support of status updates, which I did my best to untag myself from. I didn't want to be a part of their mourning. I didn't want to be involved in someone else's grief when I knew so little about how to deal with my own. My brother's wife recently posted a video of my brother crying at our mother's grave. He was in a low crouch over the plain gray slab, his hand pressed against it for balance. He was wearing glasses that he must have purchased from the drugstore because he's never been to an eye doctor in his life. There was the argyle sweater vest and lilac button-down shirt of some kind and ugly brown slacks and huge shoes, Sunday clothes. Crying on a grainy, blurry video taken with a cheap to-go phone down in Alabama, crying like a baby, crying like someone full of softness and heart. The audio crackled, broke open, and his crying turned to a soft wail, and then the video shut off. I do not know what to do with such mourning or such grief. The world in which my brother is not only moved to emotion but to open tears at the grave of our mother is a world that I don't know how I came to inhabit. Watching the video, I felt as if I had slipped out of my life and into some gray replica tucked behind the real thing, a life glimpsed at the corner of the eye where anything is possible. Cancer is a disease of proliferation, a disease of abundance. The body consumes itself to make cancer cells, so in one sense, it is a disease of success run wild, turning to ruin. I feel a measure of pain for my cousin as she watches her father, W, die in this way. My cousin and I were brought up together. My father watched her while my aunt worked, and we spent almost every moment of every day in each other's company. Before she was born, I was the baby of the family, and so her mother had doted and loved on me. Sometimes it felt as though we shared a mother and a father, though our parents were brother and sister. In a way, my cousin is my little sister, but she has her own father and I my own mother, dying and dead respectively. I check her social media pages frequently for updates on her father, and though I am not sorry he is dying, it hurts to watch her suffer and grieve. When I moved away from home to go to college, I spoke to my parents once every 2 months because it was all I could bear. The shape of our conversation was the same every time. Hello, yes, how are you? Fine. Guess who died? It was a never-ending stream of names, some old, some not, but all mostly too young to have died. Second cousins, third cousins, neighbors, friends of my parents, each passing out of this world and into whatever hangs behind this world like a second eyelid. My mother was placed on a ventilator, and later I was alerted via text message that she had died. I don't mean to imply that I feel angry about this. It was by choice that I refused to speak on the phone to people who thought I needed comfort. The text message was from another cousin, a different cousin, not the daughter of my rapist. I found out my grandfather died by browsing Facebook one morning before a biochemistry exam. I imagine I'll find out that W died via Facebook. It must be what I keep looking for, that final update, that final confirmation that he is gone out of the world. Sometimes I wonder if my cousin knows that I am hanging around her Facebook like a ghost, like a fiend. Technology lets us believe we are living parallel lives, both in and out of the world, both here and there. I can skim the facts of other people's lives from their posts like foam from boiled milk. How many people, when my mother died, came to my page to wish me love and light? How many returned time and again looking for some clue of my pain or anguish or grief? Isn't that what we do? We scent tragedy in the air and we trace it, not to its source, but to those most affected. We try to make sense of it by watching them grapple with it. In this way, we aren't living parallel lives at all. We're leeches, proliferating in a still pool of light. Spectating isn't living after all. It's consumption, grist for the mill. Yet I cannot look away from my cousin's page. There is a point at which the glimpsed becomes the central, becomes the whole of the thing. I turn my head and look. I stare because I know how to watch a person wither from abundance. I know how to read status updates like a person reads the air to discern the chance of rain. There are the upbeat messages, the ones about the fight. At chemo with this guy, he's so strong, he's a fighter. When things are looking grim, there are more vague messages about God and the meaningfulness of his plan. God will always make a way. It's not over until God says it's over. I find it difficult to imagine how anyone could even feign sadness at W's state, though to understand, I need only look back at my journals from the time that my mother was sick. It's not that I was mournful or sad exactly, but rather that I didn't want her to die. I wanted her to go on living in the strictest sense of the word, to be standing on this side of death, not even perfectly healed, just not dead. And if I could come to such a place with my own mother, who was in every way poorly suited for the task of motherhood, then I suppose it need not be impossible to imagine that W could have people in his life, like his daughter, who want him to live. My brother once called me a hard person. I think he meant that I am a person who does not forgive. This is true. I find it difficult to forgive people who have done harm to me. I am this way out of necessity. because if I do not remember the harm done to me, then no one will, and the boy that I was will have no one to look out for him. If I do not remember and do not hold people accountable for that boy's pain, then no one will remember it, and no one will remember that it was not acceptable for him to be treated that way. If I forgive all of the things done to me, done to the boy that I was, then I will betray everything I promised that boy when we endured those things. The only way through all of it was to promise that I would remember it and that at some point I would make it known what happened there. I am a hard person because hardness is what comes from a life lived underground. The hard part of me would like nothing more than to keep refreshing, waiting for the moment when my cousin's grief is obvious and clear, because that will mean that I no longer have to live my life like a clenched fist. At the same time, the fact that my freedom can only come with my cousin's suffering is something nearly unbearable to me. Spectating isn't free. No one gets something for nothing.
The Sun, by Emma Smith Stevens. My childhood had been fed to me like rancid meat. I was forced to swallow it down, gagging until I vomited. But I was not raped. There had been a guy in his 20s who scanned my 13-year-old body, all Manhattan rooftop tan and a tiny silver bikini, and said, "How old are you?" And I said, "Old enough." And he laughed and said, "You're some pretty little jailbait," and he never laid a finger on me. By that point, I had been hurt when men touched me. But this hurt too, when he turned me down. The truth is, I should have been glad. It would have been wrong for him to touch me. In junior high school, I had been the confidant of the 40-year-old manager of a neighborhood restaurant who said I was the only one who understood his sexual problems with his wife, which he detailed to me explicitly. But to his credit, between his sordid confessions, he taught me a lot about chess. I had loved a boy once, and he had dumped me just a week after I went down on him for the first time. But I had felt so fortunate that he had ever wanted me at all. I gave a blowjob to a boy I'd crushed on for a year in a shed in the alley behind our high school. A few days later, he started hooking up with one of my best friends. But at least before he ditched me, he smiled dreamily and said, "Wow, thank you. That is the nicest thing anyone's ever done for me." That is how I became the patron saint of blowjobs, and isn't that divine? The previous summer, I'd given a blowjob to a man in his late 30s, putrid and wearing a wedding ring, in the back of a city bus. He had bought me a beer, and I drank it. Later, he pushed my head down into his lap, and I had surrendered to the moment. If what that man did strikes you as wrong, let me reassure you the way I reassured myself. The marriage was only for his wife's citizenship. We were co-workers, and I had acquiesced at every turn, no hesitation or complaint. I had loved girls to whom I was nothing more than an experiment, but weren't they my experiments too? Sophomore year, I had been invited to a birthday party by the hottest guy in my homeroom, and the party had turned out to be five guys watching porn and me, just me. I quickly downed four or five shots of vodka and thought, "Okay, let's cut to the chase. Let's not let this be a group activity." So I took one boy's hand, the one who had invited me, and I led him to the bathroom and fucked him so hard on the tile floor, no condom, and later his friends taunted me, "Whore, slut." In school the next week, that boy wouldn't speak to me or look me in the eye, but at least I didn't get pregnant or catch anything. So many times, my mind left my body only to return to find it soiled. The foul residue of a grown man, or a boy from my high school, or the grime of a full week without showering. But I had never told anyone no, let alone tried to fight anyone off. I had said yes, give me more, moaned like in porno. I could have refused or washed it all away. Options not every girl is afforded. I was hospitalized the fall of my senior year. Maybe it was my third psychiatric hospitalization, or my fifth or sixth. Whatever the number, it was nothing. There were kids in the adolescent unit with me who had been in and out a dozen times. My psychiatrist in that hospital, a bearded man in a plaid shirt and khakis, explained my situation to me. "You cut, you burn, you disassociate," he said. Classic borderline. And when I told him that I didn't relate to the pamphlet they'd given me about borderline personality disorder, he said, "Listen, this diagnosis is best case scenario for you. So much better than bipolar disorder. Trust me, kid." So I was lucky. Therapy could fix me. A few months later, I would be diagnosed with bipolar 1 disorder with psychotic features, be properly medicated, and have my first glimpse of sanity since I was 12 years old. At least I made it to that point. Many people never get properly diagnosed. And people with my illness, living just a few decades before me, were routinely lobotomized. The doctor in that hospital was right about some things. I cut, I burned, my head took me somewhere else. Not so much another world as a terrifying version of this one, filled with morbid scenes and demonic voices. Sometimes I lashed out at myself and other people. And who was I to do that? What right did I have? So the hospital doctor gave me a book about borderline personality disorder to read. He told me to record all my thoughts and feelings in a journal, stop being defensive in group therapy sessions, and I would be okay. But he offered no explanation for my hallucinations and sleeplessness and my sense of unreality, for which I took high doses of antipsychotic medication. Maybe he thought I just liked the drugs, that I enjoyed taking tiny shuffling steps in the way my hands shook. If I stood up too quickly, I passed out. A side effect. I slurred. I drooled. My intellect was drowned in the infinite numbness. Thank goodness I wouldn't need to take the medication forever, so said my doctor and the pamphlet he had gifted me. How blessed I was to be in such a good place, a fancy mental hospital. It had grounds with old trees and well-tended shrubbery, a gazebo. The food was edible. All kinds of therapy, 12-step meetings, cigarette breaks whenever. We had a big TV with cable, always tuned to MTV, and this was back when MTV showed music videos. I had been in hospitals before where I hadn't been outside for weeks and all anyone watched was soap operas. Two guys were always in control of the TV remote. Let's call them A and B. Both were 18 years old. They weren't psychiatric patients. They were in the hospital for heroin addiction. They loved the band Korn, who had a hit song then, Falling Away From Me. A and B watched the music video for Falling Away From Me over and over, turning up the volume whenever it came on. In the video, a raging father in a stained wife beater bangs his fists on his young daughter's door late at night, and the terrified girl climbs out her bedroom window and runs away, running, clearly, for her life. Thank God the girl makes it out alive. The video reminded me of something really upsetting, something I couldn't quite focus on for fear that I would die if I saw it head on. But I know this for sure. The threatening memory had nothing to do with my own father. Unlike the father in the video, my father was, and is, a kind and gentle man. One afternoon, the Korn video was playing, the music seeping into the background of my mind where everything went in those days. The news, the weather, the people who loved me, my physical movements, my emotions, the college application essay I was expected to be writing during my time in that hospital. All the stuff of life, my life, reminded me of the song's title. The video was no more near or far than my own hand, the filthy couch I sat on, the cuts I made on my breasts where the text never checked, the November leaves I could see out the window, brown and crumbling. The medications made everything that way, here and not here. But again, I was told I wouldn't need them forever. Borderline, not bipolar, blessed by my DNA. I looked at A, skinny and tall, with a shaved, narrow head. B was bloated, pale, acne'd, smelled perpetually of fried food. I floated above myself. The music thrashing from the TV was muffled. The chair I sat in was orbiting space. I appraised my desire to kick my foot through its screen without feeling a thing. "Wanna fuck?" I whispered to A. A looked at B, and then at the two doorways to the room we were in. There were no texts visible, but they could be listed.